You remember what our formula for Paul last week was in Philippians 3:13? Four things. I'm not going to ask you to repeat them, so I'll repeat them so you can. This one thing I do, forgetting the things that are behind, I press forward toward the mark of the prize and the high calling. Four things. I focus my life. I concentrate. Second, I manage the past by the discipline of forgetfulness. The third, I understand it takes hard work. I press forward. I swim upstream. And the fourth, I anticipate the prize, which is automatic because it's based on the promises of God. And it's this anticipation of the prize that makes it possible to do the other three things. If you have no hope of getting in the game, you have trouble practicing, don't you? Yeah, you practice because you're going to get in the game. And Paul said, I am assured of the hope. After the class, somebody came to me and said, I wish I could practice the discipline. I wish I could learn the discipline of forgetfulness. And I wanted to just be able to sit down with him and say, well, here are some practical suggestions that I have found in my own life that have been very helpful. The importance of discipline, I think, came this week. How many of you saw the 100th anniversary of Carnegie Hall? Oh, wasn't that a magnificent thing? Oh, I watched it. You know, two words kept coming out. Tradition, discipline. Tradition, discipline. Nobody gets to Carnegie Hall without discipline. Paul was a great example for discipline. Follow me as I follow Christ. He was always saying, you can do what I do, because what I do is discipline. He was never one to say, do as I say, but not as I do. Paul didn't have any false humility. Paul knew he was paying the price of discipline. And so, let me tell you the secret of discipline. It's always demanding a dedicated, definite decision. You can't have discipline without decision. Let me read you what Aristotle said. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. I spoke on mentoring out in San Diego the other night to a large audience. And they were asking me, and because I do a lot of mentoring, have all my life, what do you look for in somebody to mentor? One of the things I look for is somebody who can create habits. If a person cannot create habits, they can't be disciplined into being big accomplishers. Because the habits turn into reflexes. And reflexes are what Paul was talking about. Remember in the scripture it says, let not your heart be troubled. See, that's a mental discipline. It didn't say this is a suggestion. He said, let not your heart be troubled. Now, if it was impossible to do, it wouldn't be in the scripture. Another scripture says, trust the Lord with all your heart and lean not upon your own understanding. What does that mean? That doesn't mean not to use your sense. I was with Warren Wisby not long ago, and he was talking about some of the writing I do in Leadership Magazine. And Warren said, Smith, keep up the consecrated common sense. I accept it as a compliment because I think common sense is concentrated. It is not leaning on your own understanding. What that scripture means to me is that you don't put your understanding in conflict with scripture. It isn't that you don't use your mind. It's that you never put your own thinking in conflict with scripture. Anytime I teach anything that is in conflict with scripture, I am wrong. But you don't see me doing an awful lot of proof texting because I think proof texting is very dangerous. But I think almost any position you want to take, you can find text to support it. But you have to use the spirit of the scripture within the context. And so, let me give you quickly some disciplines that I have found personally to be very helpful to me. First is always let the positive drive out the negative. Never try to rid yourself of negative things by just getting rid of the negative. The only way you can get rid of the negative is by bringing in the positive. What did Paul say? After he said his formula in the third chapter, then you go over in the fourth chapter, and what does he say in the eighth verse of fourth of Philippians? Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me do, and the God of peace will be here with you. What was Paul saying? He was saying there's only one way to get rid of the negative, and that is to crowd it out with the positive. The Baptists are known for being negative. If you talk to non-believers or you talk to other non-believers, you ask them for some common denominators of Baptists, and they'll say, they're negative. They don't believe in dancing. They don't believe in cards. They don't believe in drinking. You can't do this, you can't do that, and you can't do the other. That's a terrible reputation. We should not be known for what we don't do. We ought to be known for what we do do. Because we only do the negatives in order to do the positives. Executive vice president of a bank came in my office not long ago. He'd lost his job due to one of the mergers. And he said to me, Fred, why is God letting this happen to me? I've lost my job. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't run around with my wife. I don't cheat. I don't steal. He said, I'm a good Christian. Is that being a good Christian? A lot of people have the misconception that if you don't do the negatives, you're being a good Christian. No. You don't do the negatives so you can do the positives. And if we don't do the positives, we're wasting our time on doing the negatives. Why? Because if we just do the negatives, we create a vacuum in our life. And all through the scripture says, do not create vacuums in your life. You remember what it says? If you sweep your life clean of the one devil, what'll happen? Seven more come back and take its place. And so you have to fiddle with the goodness. Rather, for example, the negative Christians that I have known who have been most proud of what they didn't do are always self-righteous. Negative disciplines in the Christian faith, unless you are doing it to do something positive, creates self-righteousness. And was there anything that Christ talked against anymore than self-righteousness? Being proud of what you don't do? Let me give you the second one. That is, build your scenarios on fact. Most of us build the scenarios in our life on rumor and on fear. I hear people always saying, what if? What if? What if? One of the great phrases for me is, what is the current reality? Now, what was, what might be, what is? What's the current reality? And this is what we build our scenarios on fact. It's a young woman in Florida, 2 years now. She's been writing me and calling me, talking to me, what if she lost her job? You think of all the pain she's gone through for 2 years, and she's still got the same job. But she can't give up the what if, the building the scenario on the what if. People say to me, I don't want to take a physical examination. Why? What if I found I was sick? I tell my doctor friends, every major sickness starts with a visit to the doctor. And they agree with that, but it isn't the visit that creates the sickness. But this is building the scenarios of our life on the negative sorts of things. I was in Chicago speaking to the National Safety Congress, and I left Mary Alice in Cincinnati with the three kids. And when I got back to the hotel, the Palmer House there, I had a message, call home. Well, you know, if you're a person who builds negative scenarios, I mean, there's no better time than if you get back and they say, call home. I mean, it couldn't be anything good. I mean, it has to be a major catastrophe. So I just knew exactly what it was. We had bought our son a bicycle. He hadn't learned to ride it real well. He had nagged his mother until he was able to convince her he ought to ride it to school. He had gotten out in the street, a car had hit him, and he was in the hospital, almost dead. I mean, it was such a sensible scenario. I mean, anybody would know that's exactly what happened. I called him and I said, I've been able to get a babysitter, and if you want me to, I'll join you in Chicago. I'd wasted so much good time, you know, in the negative. But you'll see people get a long-distance call. They say, what's wrong? They are used to building the scenarios of their life, not on facts, but on rumors and on fears. I had to learn that about worry. When I got my first good job, I worried all the time. I was afraid I was going to lose it. And I didn't know what I'd do if I lost that good job. Man, this is a job I liked. I wanted to keep this job. And so I started worrying about it. Now, I became a pro, not an amateur. If you're an amateur worrier, go ahead and worry. Don't worry about it. But now, if you're a pro, now what I did, I mean, I didn't take my worries and go to bed. I was afraid of going to sleep. And I mean, you just couldn't keep your self-respect as a worrier if you found that you'd gone to sleep and you ought to have been worrying. So what I'd do is brew a big pot of coffee. I'd get in a rocking chair and I'd sit and rock and drink coffee. Rock and drink coffee. And worry. When I went back to bed, I mean, I didn't lay there and toss. I laid there and perked. Now, I had to do something about that. It was affecting my health. I was beginning to get pre-ulcerative situation. So I said to myself, let's analyze this. For 2 years, I analyzed it. Can I hold my job if I'm worrying? I can't do the best job I can do. Well, if worry is going to hurt me to hold my job, then why do I keep worrying about losing my job? So it just made a lot of sense. I wrote three little words on the inside of my skull. I'm sure if you performed a craniotomy, you'd find these three little words engraved on my brain. Wait to worry. Wait to worry. When the kids were small, Mary Alice would be at the kitchen sink. She'd hear a scream in the front yard. She'd take off her apron and take off of the front door like a jaybird with its tail on fire, just expecting to find blood all over the grass. By the time she got there, the kids already dusted himself off in the backyard, and she don't even see him. Then she just comes back limp to the sink. I say, honey, you've done enough worrying between that kitchen sink and that front door to fill the Empire State Building. If you could just wait to worry. I want to be honest with you. After that 2 years of analysis, I have never worried a single day that I can remember since that time. Because I'm always saying to myself, wait to worry. Don't build your life scenarios on fears and rumors. Build them on facts. Survey of worriers, several thousand worriers, they found out that 40% of what people worry about is already passed. 30% never will happen. 22% when he gets here, it'll be so minor you won't worry about it. 8% will be real. If you're an average, ordinary worrier, you're 92% inefficient. You couldn't hold your job being that inefficient to save your life. Third thing, first, let the positive drive out the negative. Second, build your scenarios of life on facts. Third, turn your unpleasant experiences into experiments. This has been one of the most valuable things I've learned. You in management know that the Hawthorne experiment is one of the great multi-million-dollar experiment, the Hawthorne Electric experiment. It was written in a book called Working Morale. I read it many, many years ago. And they did this study on what would increase production, and they found that everything it did increased production. They'd turn the lights up, production go up. They'd turn them on, and no matter what they did, production would go up. And so they just put the work aside and didn't understand it. A psychologist came along and took the work out and studied fresh. Oh, and he said, oh, I see. What happens is you create an experimental syndrome. And this experimental syndrome causes people to act positively. And so when we have unpleasant experiences in our life, if we will create experiments, John Gregg, who owned Roselawn Cemetery in Whittier, California, the second biggest cemetery in the world, was a friend of mine, and I dropped out there one day to see him. And he said, attend our sales meeting. They had 100 salesmen selling cemetery lots. I really got very intrigued with selling cemetery lots, particularly those who were getting more for those in the shade than they were in the open field. I mean, you know, you know, and, you know, I got so intrigued with it that I wanted to sell periscopes so they could have a view. You know? But they had a tremendous turnover among these salesmen. Why? Because they were going door to door and people were slamming their door in their face. And the turnover was simply tremendous. So I remember the Hawthorne experiment. So I said, wait a minute, let me draw up an experiment for these people and see if it changes their feelings. So I drew up a card which said, one hard door slammer, one woman door slammer, one kid door slammer, one quick door slammer, one slow. And all and the salesman did. All they did, they took the card. And when somebody slammed the door, they just marked them down. See? It changed an experience into an experiment. And we had a decrease of 50% of turnover in that sales force. Constantly, I found it very useful in my life. I went to a dentist. I carried a stopwatch. He wasn't greatly impressed when I walked in. What I was doing was turning a bad experience into an experiment. I don't like dentist visits. And so I took my stopwatch and I said, I'm only going to run it when I hurt. Yeah. Not when I think I'm going to hurt or when I expect to hurt or when I hear somebody else yell. I mean, not. I'm just going to run it when I hurt. And I sat there and I ran my watch when I hurt. Can you guess how long I ran my watch in that total visit? 4 seconds. 4 seconds. See, I had turned an unpleasant experience into an experiment. I have to tell you this because it was one that drove it home to me. I was speaking at an International Women's Convention, Banff, Canada. Wonderful executive women who own businesses. And I got to visiting with some of them. One of them was telling me, she said, I came up in very poor circumstances. Said, I started as a seater and a greeter in a hotel coffee shop. And said, one day I was seating and a greeting, and these smart aleck salesmen were coming in. You know, the kind that have great remarks for, you know, waitresses. You know, how are you feeling? What do you care? You know, doctor. I mean, you know, all that kind of stuff. She said, she got to crying. Old Jewish salesman called over and said, honey, what you crying about? Said, people. They drive me crazy. Said, you want a system where you'll never worry about people again? Said, I sure do. Said, go over to the drugstore next door and bring me a Blue Horse notebook. That puts a little time on it. And he took this little Blue Horse notebook, very small, and divided it into 4 sections. Now, in church, I have to tell you this in a delicate sort of way, but I want you still to get it because it's a true story. Now, the first one, he just headed by heels. The second, he put one word which indicated the parents had not gone through the social amenities of marriage. And the third, he put 3 letters which indicated that some of the relatives barked instead of talked. And on the fourth, he put gentlemen. Now, he said, whenever you seat anybody, you just qualify him. One heel, one illegitimate, you know, one SOB, one gentleman. Said, I found that I got so many more gentlemen that the others got to where they didn't bother me. But said, then I got to running ratios for the week. And said, I got interested in it. And said, 1 week I was short, one SOB. And said, I was so happy when he came in. There he was. There he was. A wonderful discipline, simply to turn your unpleasant experiences into experiments. The fourth one is simply this, and that's the need to overcome peer pressure. I was talking to a group of Highland Park businessmen at a retreat a short time ago, and we were talking about the pressures that are on us to do things in our family and the lifestyle we live. And I finally said, does it ever occur to us that we have the responsibility to take charge of our life? Take charge of your life. If God is going to judge us for the life we live, we need to take charge of the life we live. It isn't just kids who have peer pressure. We all have peer pressure. Here's one of the finest ways I've ever found to handle peer pressure. The professor of psychology at one of the universities has written the Abilene Syndrome. It comes out of a true story, his own story. And it's now a well-accepted syndrome in psychology. Have you ever heard about it? The Abilene Syndrome? What it was, this professor of psychology, a rancher's daughter went to college, and she met the professor, and he fell in love with her, and they got married. And so, shortly after the wedding, he came out to the ranch, which was just a working ranch. And it was a hot day. And so they were sitting under a fan because they didn't have air conditioning then in Abilene, or 50 miles out of Abilene. And so the father said, why don't we all get in the car and go to Abilene for lunch? Well, the daughter said, that's a great idea. And her new husband said, yeah, that's fine. And mother said, well, let me go along with you. Well, they got in the car, hot, dusty, no air conditioning, went to the restaurant and had a lousy meal. Rode back home. And they got back home, and the daughter said, wasn't that wonderful? And the mother said, no, it's terrible. Said, never had such a miserable time in my life. Well, the daughter said, I agree with you. I was miserable too. Well, said, why did we do it? Well, said, Daddy wanted to do it. He said, no, I didn't want to do it. I wanted to stay home. But I thought the professor would be bored at home. So I thought we ought to ride up to Abilene. And the professor said, well, I only did it because your daughter thought it was a good idea. I didn't want to do it. And so the mother said, I didn't want to go at all, but I didn't want to be left here alone. Now, this is a completely good psychological syndrome of how people will agree to things that they don't want to agree to. Peers do it. You get three kids in a car, and you get almost any kind of behavior out of them, because they put peer pressure on each other. We have to, if we're going to have a good discipline about our life, we have to overcome peer pressure simply by having the good judgment to say, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea. Fifth one, that is maintain a sense of humor. See, I'm just talking about common sense things today. Consecrated common sense. You can't find a list of good qualities of mature people and healthy people anywhere that doesn't have a sense of humor. Maintain a sense of humor. At Harvard, they've done a 30-year study of successful executives, the longest study they've ever done in one group of executives. And they found four things, four common denominators. One of them was they have a good sense of humor that lets them laugh at themselves. You know, I've never seen anybody without a sense of humor that wasn't arrogant. That's a strange statement. I've never seen anybody without a sense of humor that wasn't arrogant. They think they're going to control things. They're not going to be impressed with anybody else. They're in charge. Pious people have very great difficulty in laughing at themselves. Politicians, people in power. I mean, it's like taking a pin in a balloon factory. I mean, it just isn't one of the things they want there. If we have a healthy ability, how long has it been since you really laughed at yourself? Every day, nearly. I find what in our family we say, laugh, I have high blood pressure. I wish I could tell you some of the things which are a little bit too intimate in our family to talk about, but just where we've had to laugh. I was vice president of operations of the Grooming Watch Company, and we came out with a new watch, a man's watch, you know, with the face of the size of a man's watch. And we bored out the inside and put a ladies' movement in there, and it was plexiglass. And today, you know, it was just a tremendous thing. You look through that plexiglass and see those works moving in there. We just knew we were going to sell every oil. We were White Boulevard out. There wasn't any question about that. I was walking through the plant. We always named our watches by men's names, our women's watches by women's names. As I walked through the plant, I came upon a group having coffee break. And so one of them said to me, "Miss Smith, how are we going to do with the Liberace?" I knew exactly what he was talking about. And we didn't want that watch called the Liberace. I said, "What you mean the Liberace?" He said, "The male model with the female movement." Now, what you going to do? You're going to laugh. I have high blood pressure. I just laughed. You know, the truth is, we didn't sell a hatful of them. Not a hatful. I think God is always interested in hearing his saints laugh, because he knows that his saints always ain't saintly. And in the qualities where we're wrong, we have the humility to simply say, "I goofed." Laugh about it. Don't get mad. Don't try to rationalize it. Don't try to get it in any kind of other shape. "I just goofed. I made a mistake." Laugh. Those are the disciplines. What are they? First, always let the positive drive out the negative. Build your scenarios in life on facts, not on rumors or fears. And that way you learn to wait to worry. Third one, turn your unpleasant experiences into experiments. Four, overcome peer pressure by just simply saying, "I'm in charge of my life. I don't want to do that," and not fall into the Abilene syndrome. Fifth, is simply maintain a sense of humor, knowing you're not quite perfect yet. And that way you'll be a whole lot easier to live with, and you'll have a whole lot fewer ulcers. I hope those will be helpful to you. Just kind of a follow-up of our lesson last Sunday.